those people who are in direct contact with the president need to say, no, I'll resign. I'll do whatever I can do legally to stop this because this is insane. And if given the order, I'm not carrying it out.
Wow. When Trump has lost Tucker, who's next? Alex Jones?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Wait, what?
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. As promised, we are both catching up with stuff that we missed over spring break last week and trying to keep up with the madness underway this week. To that end,
yes, everybody on pins and needles.
Yes,
as we
indeed,
go to air.
We are. We will be joined momentarily by a longtime now former top DOJ official with a bit of a postmortem on the firing of Trump's indescribably corrupt Attorney General Pam Bondi, the damage caused to both the rule of law and the DOJ itself by her year-long tenure at the top of DOJ, and what happens next for Bondi, for the department, and yes, for whatever is left of the rule of law at this point. Our guest is standing by, but quickly first, this is a very weird moment to be going to air, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
We are a couple of hours before the Tuesday 8 p.m. Eastern time deadline that Trump vowed as part of his profane Easter Sunday threat to unleash hell on Iran's civilian power plants and bridges if they refuse to open up the Strait of Hormuz, which just about a week ago he said he did not care much about. He'd let other countries worry about that. I guess he changed his mind again. On Sunday, he used words that we cannot say on FCC radio in order to make threats that amount to a war crime against Iran. On Monday, he repeated that threat, and on Tuesday morning on his failing social media site, he said, and I quote, "A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again." Now, the markets responded very poorly to that on Tuesday morning, not exactly going over a cliff, but taking a very swift run down a very steep hill with oil prices running up in the other direction. But by day's end, the markets recovered a little bit on Tuesday and oil fell back down, suggesting that the markets anyway are perhaps counting on another Taco Tuesday. But we will see, betting that Trump will chicken out again. In the meantime, many of Trump's longtime supporters suggest, at least, that they are now finally jumping off of this sinking ship, or so they say, with many seeming to agree with the argument that we have been making for some time, that Trump is not just off the rails, but quickly devolving into madness at this point, and that, yes, he even needs to be removed from office. As longtime progressive blogger Oliver Willis writes over at Daily Coast today, President Donald Trump threatened the death of Iran's civilization on Tuesday, an escalation of his ongoing threats to commit international war crimes against that nation. Trump's incendiary rhetoric validated long-running warnings from the Democratic Party about Trump issuing illegal orders to the U.S. military. He said that the U.S. would be targeting Iran's civilian infrastructure, hitting facilities like energy plants, water treatment centers, key roads and bridges. Targeting such structures is a war crime, Willis correctly notes. A coalition of Democrats in the Senate and House have been issuing warnings for months now about behavior just like this. In November, you will recall several senators and representatives who either served in the military or national security capacity released a video advising troops not to follow illegal orders. The administration had a meltdown in response at the time, led by Trump himself, who falsely claimed that Democrats had committed, quote, treason with that video. After which Trump's now former Attorney General Pam Bondi actually attempted to investigate those sitting members of Congress for the supposed crime of reminding active troops of their duty to refuse to carry out unlawful orders. In response to Trump's insane Sunday tweet, an arguably more insane post on Tuesday, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that the post was evidence Trump is, quote, an extremely sick person. Ohio Rep. Chantel Brown said the post was, quote, totally insane. Rep. Pramila Jayapal of Washington wrote, quote, this threat is outrageous, dangerous, and unhinged. Illinois Democratic Congressman Sean Casten wrote, quote, there are 90 million people in Iran. Delivering on a fraction of this unhinged, insane threat would be the greatest war crime of all time. But as Willis notes, even some of Trump's most outspoken supporters slammed his support for war crimes. Now, on yesterday's show, we shared some of those, some of longtime MAGA Trump supporter and now former Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's response to Trump's Easter Sunday threat, responding on Sunday that, quote, he has gone insane. That, quote, this is evil, Green said, and calling on members of the administration to, quote, intervene in Trump's madness. Green even suggested that Trump should be removed from office under the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution after he doubled down on his threat in that other post on Tuesday that said a whole, quote, a whole civilization will die tonight. Senator Ron Johnson, a Wisconsin Republican, staunch Trump ally, he said, quote, I am hoping and praying this really is bluster. And prominent far-right Fox News host turned podcaster Tucker Carlson, as you heard a bit of at the top of the show there, said that Trump's Easter post was, quote, vile on every level. Quote, it begins with a promise to use the military, our military, to destroy civilian infrastructure in another country, Carlson said, which is to say, commit a war crime, a moral crime against the people of the country. Good for Tucker Carlson. He also said that destroying power plants would lead to the death of civilians, saying, quote, babies connected to incubators die. People in hospitals die. Which is important to point out when you think about Trump and what he's promising to, you know, oh, we're going to bomb every one of their power plants and their bridges. When he's talking about destroying power plants, he's talking about, yes, babies connected to incubators who die without power. People in hospitals who die without power. People who have no drinking water because in Iran, they use desalination plants to take the salt out of the ocean water so they have water to drink. Those people will have nothing to drink. Those people will die. Carlson added that Trump's post also mocks Christians and is, quote, evil. In response, Trump turned on Carlson, calling him, quote, a low IQ person that has absolutely no idea what's going on, which is strange because he usually plays the low IQ card on women and black people, so he must be really mad at Tucker Carlson. The, quote, the 25th Amendment needs to be invoked. He is a genocidal lunatic. That from far-right podcaster Candace Owens. To her 7.8 million followers adding, quote, "Our Congress and military need to intervene. We are beyond madness." Anthony Scaramucci, who briefly served in Trump's first administration as his communications director, said, quote, "Wake up. He is calling for a nuclear strike. Seek his removal immediately," said Scaramucci. And disgraced podcaster and, at least until today, huge Trump supporter who was right there with him on January 6, 2021, Alex Jones, called Trump's threat, quote, "the definition of genocide," or "the definition of genocide." He said he talks like a supervillain from a Marvel comic. Yeah, just about. On his show on Monday, Jones asked his guest, Robert Barnes, quote, "how do we 25th Amendment his ass?" To which Barnes responded, essentially, that someone needed to do what they reportedly did with Donald Trump's own father when he began suffering from dementia. They supposedly set up a fake office for him to go to every day with a fake secretary and everything to pretend like he was still running the company.
How do we 25th Amendment his ass?
The problem is to get the 25th Amendment's harder than impeachment. You have to get 2/3 of the House and 2/3 of the Senate.
So what do we do?
Tackle Trump and pretend, let him pretend he's president and publicly report that he's going through a health issue and Vance take over. It literally needs to be something like that. It's that bad.
I've known you a long time. You've never called for an internal coup before.
Ever. But that's how dangerous this is. That's how risky it is for the whole world.
Yeah, if I was the Democrats, I'd stop poking Trump and messing with him. That only makes it worse. Like, you guys need to watch out. This isn't a guy acting like he's crazy. This is real.
Well, what's there going to be to take over in 2026 or 2028 if this hits the fan? If we get it, he's threatening an extinction level event for the people of Iran tomorrow. Dude, does nobody think there'll be any blowback from that? If he follows through on that, the whole world is screwed.
Yes, Robert Barnes is absolutely correct in talking to Alex Jones. I don't know what the hell Alex Jones is talking about when Democrats need to stop poking Donald Trump. Last week, Jones said it's time to, quote, cut bait on Trump because the president, quote, is in free fall. Well, if that's not poking at the president, I don't know what it is. What, is Alex Jones allowed to do so, but nobody else is? And that was, by the way, Jones talking about cutting bait on Trump, calling him in free fall. That was before the threats that Trump made on Easter Sunday and repeated on Monday and then vowed essentially to wipe out an entire civilization forever on Tuesday. So I don't know what's going to happen in a few hours' time after we get off the air today. Whatever it is, if we're still here, we will talk about it on tomorrow's broadcast, I'm sure. But if Trump's top supporters are calling for him to be 25th amendmented, well, I guess at least we were ahead of that curve here on this show. Either way,
true.
Whether he tacos or not, as the markets seem to be suggesting, this is a man who is quickly swirling around the drain. At least, as I say, if you listen to his top supporters today, not to me, but to his top supporters. How will they feel tomorrow? Well, that remains to be seen. But anyway, yeah, I know, strange bedfellows that I am citing Alex Jones and Candace Owen and Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene, but these are very strange times indeed. Speaking of strange times, things have been very strange and unimaginably corrupt over the past year for folks at Donald Trump's Department of Justice and for the longtime veterans thereof. The DOJ's former chief of its fraud and public corruption section in D.C., Randall Eliason, joins us next for a postmortem on Pam Bondi and maybe even for the rule of law in America. Also, I think it'll be our first Green News report since returning from spring break, if time allows.
Yep.
All of that straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. While we were off for our spring break last week, Donald Trump fired his Attorney General, Pam Bondi. Bye-bye. She will be replaced, for now, by Donald Trump's criminal defense attorney, underscore criminal, and his department, his deputy attorney general, Todd Blanche, who will serve as the acting AG for the time being, according to Trump. Announcing the firing on his failing social media site, Trump said that Bondi would be, quote, transitioning to a much needed and important new job in the private sector, praising her for her work in his administration and offering no specific reason for why she would be leaving, nor explaining what that, quote, important new job would be in the private sector. Quote, Pam Bondi is a great American patriot and a loyal friend who faithfully served as my attorney general over the past year. He went on to say that she, quote, did a tremendous job, but of course, he fired her anyway for some reason. For her part, Bondi said that she's moving on to a, quote, important private sector role I am thrilled about and where I will continue fighting, unquote, apparently for the guy who just fired her. But as Chris Brennan notes at USA Today today, Bondi has another fight coming. A broad coalition of lawyers and legal groups is planning to refile an ethics complaint against her with the Florida Bar. The group will once again accuse her of misconduct for using her former position as the nation's top law enforcement official to serve only Trump and not the Americans she swore to serve. The timing of this development, observes Brennan, is extraordinarily exquisite. Bondi, before she got fired, proposed a new federal regulation that would give the attorney general the power to hijack the process that state bar associations use to investigate ethics complaints filed against Department of Justice lawyers. The 30-day period for public comment about that proposed new regulation actually ended on April 6th, just on Monday this week. More than a million people left comments on the Federal Register, and it looks like the bulk of them opposed Bondi's proposed regulation. They don't want the DOJ to shield public service from ethics complaints. Bondi, however, is now no longer a DOJ lawyer, so her proposed rule, even if it were to go into effect, presumably would no longer protect her. But the lawyers and legal groups looking to hold her accountable have been frustrated so far by the Florida Bar, which rejected the ethics complaint that they filed initially against Bondi back in June on the basis that it does not, quote, investigate or prosecute sitting officers appointed under the U.S. Constitution while they are in office, unquote. Well, guess who's not in office anymore? Lauren Rickling, the executive director of Lawyers Defending American Democracy, told USA Today that an attorney general, like any other lawyer, quote, has an obligation to uphold the Constitution and the code of professional ethics. She is not above the law in any way, Rickling said. And the frustration of this has been, of course, that the Florida Bar took that position that indeed the attorney general was above the law and they, at least, would not investigate. Rickland said the coalition will now be meeting soon to discuss whether to refile the original 23-page complaint now or to amend it to include new allegations against Bondi. Either way, it sounds like a new ethics complaint is coming. Democracy Defenders Fund, one of the groups in the coalition, say they, quote, are fully committed to holding Pam Bondi accountable for her apparent failure to comply with her professional obligations. So, that is maybe the beginning, perhaps, of someone somewhere beginning to try and get to some sort of accountability for this incredibly corrupt takeover of our federal criminal justice system by a wildly criminal administration. Now, for many years on this program, we have turned to our friend Randall Eliason when it comes to the issue of white-collar crime and public corruption. Randall is the longtime now former chief of the Fraud and Public Corruption Section at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. He now teaches white-collar criminal law at George Washington University Law School. But where we once turned for quite a while to Randall for insight on, you know, actual law-breaking, actual public corruption and fraud, in recent years, we have turned to him nearly as much in regard to the breakdown of the Department of Justice itself under Donald J. Trump. Writing at his Sidebars blog this week, Eliason reflects on what he describes as Bondi's legacy of destruction at DOJ. Pamela Jo Bondi is out as Donald Trump's attorney general. That's good news for anyone who cares about the Department of Justice and the rule of law, Eliason observes. In just over a year in office, Bondi caused incalculable damage to the justice system and to the U.S. Justice Department, he writes, adding, quote, I fear that damage will take a generation or more to repair if it can be repaired at all. Joining us now for a bit of a requiem for Pamela Jo of sorts, or perhaps for Randall, who I recall is a fan of musical theater. Perhaps we should just call it Bye Bye Bondi. Randall D. Eliason, sir, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
I got to say, it's kind of strange to be discussing the collapse and unknown future of the U.S. Department of Justice at a moment when a seemingly unhinged president of the United States has purposely placed the world sort of on tenterhooks, promising blatant war crimes against 92 million people in Iran, threatening, quote, a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. That threat itself, of course, being a war crime, as I understand international law. But it seems that this administration and this mad president at this point, Randall, doesn't give a damn about our national laws, much less international law. So before we get to our briefer than hoped Pam Bondi postmortem here, any thoughts on this moment in American and indeed world history under a president who seems to be melting down and for whom the 25th Amendment of the Constitution, allowing the removal of a president no longer able to carry out his duties, would actually seem to have been written for?
I mean, that's the issue with this administration, right? It's always hard to know where to focus your outrage.
Yes.
But, you know, I have to say, I mean, obviously, the behavior in the last few days is incredibly disturbing, and it certainly makes you feel like the 25th Amendment will be justified. At the same time, I can't help but thinking that that's just a pipe dream.
Yeah.
Have you seen one of his cabinet meetings and the way, you know,
yeah.
and the way they go around the room, just, you know, flattering him and lying about how wonderful he is. And even the press conference about the military rescue, it's all about how wonderful he is and what a strong leader he is. And mm-hmm. the idea that this cabinet is going to vote to remove him from office just seems to me like a pipe dream, no matter how justified it might seem to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I think you'd almost have a better chance of impeachment, you know, getting a few Republicans in Congress to maybe come around than you would of getting this cabinet to remove him. But that obviously doesn't mean it's not called for, but it just seems to me like it's just not going to happen unless it would have to take a lot more than him just blustering on social media, right? He would have to actually do some kind of really right. horrible war crime rather than just threaten it. I think before this cabinet, you could even.
Yeah. Well,
this cabinet would do it. Yeah.
I will say over the past 24 hours, we've seen a lot of people who have been longtime sycophants who would have loved to have been at that table, one of those cabinet meetings, kissing up to him, sort of turning on him now, saying he's gone insane.
Yeah. No, that's true.
It's so it's a remarkable moment. And I just feel like
I'd love to be proven wrong.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm just saying. just watching the way this cabinet behaves, it just seems to me so unlikely that they would turn against him. But
so, with that in mind, to turn to one of those people at one of the, you know, many of those cabinet meetings who have been kissing up to him, a lot of good it did her. Pam Bondi, you note in your piece at Sidebar's blog today, I didn't realize this. Bondi's DOJ, you note, has shut down more than 23,000 criminal investigations into cases involving terrorism, white collar crime, drugs, and other offenses in order to shift resources to pursue immigration cases. 23,000 cases? Randall, yep. You teach white collar criminal law at George Washington University. What is that like these days when it seems that white collar crime, at least on the federal level, is seemingly all but non-existence after a year of Pam Bondi's rule at the DOJ?
No, that's what I tell everybody is that now I've become a history professor.
Yes.
Back when we used to, you know, prosecute white collar crime, these were the offenses, you know. So, no, that's right. I mean, it's certainly. I mean, is that gutting the public integrity section? You know, pardoning all kinds of white collar criminals and fraud defendants. Who don't deserve to be pardoned, but just because he thinks white collar crime in general is not worth prosecuting or not worth enforcing.
Or they paid him off enough, right?
Yeah, there's a whole industry now rising up with lobbyists and people who will help you get a pardon if you make a hefty contribution to the president or one of his political
committees. To be clear, they can do that because, as according to the U.S. Supreme Court, president is not breaking the law by essentially taking money to pardon someone, right?
Yeah, that appears that way. Yeah, you know, he's immune.
Is it fair to say that even if you're now a history professor teaching about what it used to be like when we had federal white, you know, corruption laws, is it fair to say that at least state prosecutions of such laws do continue despite the criminal Trump era free for all at the federal level?
And you know, historically, there a lot of criminal law enforcement is done at the state level. But the big cases, the really complex cases with nationwide impact, you know, were typically done by the federal government. And currently, that's just not a priority. I mean, and you know, every administration shifts priorities when it comes into office. But this change has really been dramatic. Like I said, basically doing away with the section at the Justice Department that focuses on public corruption cases. And shifting all these resources to immigration, which they then use to bring, you know, frivolous cases, cases that are contrary to the facts, cases that juries and even grand juries are rejecting, which is almost unheard of, you know, but that's where they want to put their time and energy as part of this big immigration push. So
do you have any understanding, any insight whether, because we know that they've been, of course, laying off, firing all sorts of prosecutors, really, you know, across the board at DOJ, people who are, you know, had any sort of participation whatsoever in any of the investigations, prosecutions of Donald Trump. And of course, there's, you know, just been laying off people because that's what this administration has done across the board, across the government. But
And a lot of other people quit.
And people quit. So do you have any sense of, is anybody even working there anymore? I mean, are we dealing with a DOJ that is, you know, at essentially at half staff, even if they wanted to prosecute legitimate crimes?
Well, they're definitely understaffed now because of all this, all the exit, all the people that have headed for the exits rather than work for this administration and all the ones who have been fired. And now you see offices like my old office, the DC U.S. Attorney's Office, it can't hire enough people. They've got, I think, 90 vacancies or something right now.
Wow.
And you know, there are people in the DOJ posting on Twitter, you know, about job vacancies and doing away with, they're doing away with the requirement. They used to have a requirement that you know, like have been out of law school for a while before you could be a prosecutor. They're doing away with that.
Wow.
And you know, people don't want to go work there. Those used to be back in my day. You know, these were highly coveted jobs. I mean, dozens of applicants for each vacancy. I mean, you know, really, really hard to get, and and considered to be a dream job for a lot of people and a lot of my students. And now if my students ask me, I can't advise them to go there. And I never thought that would be possible. I mean, that's been, that was my dream job my entire professional career, the idea that you could go work for the Justice Department. And that's what I always taught my students. And now that's just completely changed.
And that's, yeah, that's how I've understood it as well, that it was a dream job. Many, many people, you know, completed their entire careers there, or if not, it was, you know, pretty nice to have on your resume. I guess now at this point, having that on your resume, people are going to have to check what years exactly were you there at DOJ to determine if they should be impressed by that or not.
Depending on where you want to go work, I suppose.
Oh, there you go. Good point.
It might still be a plus to some people.
You're right. Now, in citing what you describe as, quote, Bondi's tragic track record, you distinguish between her tenure and that of Trump's previous AG during his first term, Bill Barr, who I thought at the time was sort of the paragon of corruption at the federal level. But you suggest Bondi's kind of blew him away, outpaced even him. How so, as you see it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think, and I, like I said in the piece, I mean, I wouldn't have thought somebody could make Barr look good by comparison. You know, Bondi does that. She makes Jeff Sessions look like a practical saint by comparison, you know, the Trump's first AG. No, I had a lot of problems with Barr, and I wrote a lot of stuff critical of him back when he was in office, but he did still have, and he was relentless in his, you know, pursuit of expanding executive power and doing favors for Trump cronies and a lot of things that were troubling us. Maybe the biggest one is the way he misled the public about the Mueller report and planted this idea that there was no evidence of obstruction or corruption in the Mueller report, and then withheld it for a couple of weeks until that was firmly planted in the, you remember all that whole story.
Yeah.
But, you know, he at least still had some kind of respect for the institution, for its obligations. I mean, Barr would not have taken an order from President Trump to go prosecute a particular political opponent, you know.
Yeah,
the way Bondi did, right? The way Bondi went after James Comey and Letitia James and Adam Schiff. You know, Barr wouldn't have done that.
I'll get your guy. He would get your guys off the hook. I'll get them off the hook. I'll go in and say, Mike Flynn, we should withdraw the prosecution. But I guess it's a different matter in and actually prosecuting someone for a crime that he didn't commit.
Getting someone guilty off the hook is bad,
right?
But prosecuting an innocent person is far worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, even at the, and then at the end, you know, Barr, I don't know, maybe he was trying to polish his reputation right at the end there, but you know, when Trump was claiming the election was stolen, Barr told him that was BS and ultimately left before the whole January 6th thing, you know? So, I mean, he didn't go along with all the phony claims of election fraud either. There's little doubt Bondi would have.
Yeah.
In fact, Bondi did.
Has, yeah.
As a private attorney back at the time, she was part of the team.
Right.
Trying to overturn the election, saying there was fraud in Pennsylvania, things like that. So, yeah. Again, you know, it's not a very high bar. But
no.
But the point, it was just a rhetorical point to point out just how bad Bondi was.
Yeah. I mean, you also, that some have argued that under Bondi, the Justice Department became Trump's personal law firm, but that even that is too generous.
It was worse than that.
How so? Right.
Well, if you assume a law firm would at least still try to follow the law and would obey judges' orders and would understand their obligation to be candid with the courts and things like that, you know, this DOJ hasn't done that. In fact, there's lists out there you can go find of the scores of cases where judges have ruled basically that they think the government's misled them, they think the government's lied to them, they threatened to hold prosecutors in contempt. You know, you got Todd Blanche, who's now the acting AG, saying, you know, we're at war with these rogue activist judges, which is basically any judge who does something they don't like. And there's this thing that was called the presumption of regularity, where over decades was built up, where basically courts gave the government a presumption that, you know, if a federal prosecutor, federal attorney is standing in front of you telling you this is what the government is doing or this is what the government is going to do, they would believe you. They would assume that the government is acting, you know, with candor towards the court, and will follow court orders, and that there's a presumption, absent some really strong evidence to the contrary, that the federal officials are trying to follow their obligations. That's in 1 year gone out the window. And basically now the courts don't trust this Department of Justice, and with good reason. Mm-hmm. And again, that's something that took decades and decades to build up, of decades of public servants acting in good faith who understood their obligations. And now it's just in 1 year been shredded. And it's really, really tragic. I don't know, how do you get that back, right? Yeah. I mean, it's going to take a long, long time if it can be done at all.
You list about 10 points from what you describe as, quote, the record of damage and scandal that Bondi leaves behind, calling it, quote, truly staggering. Give me what you see as the, I don't know, one or two or three top highlights or lowlights that you see as defining her staggering record of damage and scandal as we move on to the to whoever's next in line.
Well, I just described one of them. It's the whole pattern of lying to and misleading the courts and squandering that presumption of regularity that DOJ had built up over decades. Another big one is the, we talked about a few minutes ago, the desire to go after the president's political opponents and trying to use the weight of the criminal justice system to attack his enemies, not because they actually committed a crime, but because Trump doesn't like them, or Trump is mad about something else they did. And trying to bring the cases against Jim Comey and Letitia James and Jerome Powell, you know, and the six members of Congress who made the video, increasingly irrelevant video,
right?
telling members of the military that they don't have to obey lawful orders. You know, I mean, Bondi's DOJ tried to indict them.
Right.
The cases against Comey and James fell apart. You know, the investigation of Schiff is still pending, but she was willing to use the Department of Justice to pursue the president's political enemies. And that is just directly contrary to the department's mission and everything it stood for decades, you know? And the idea, I mean, that's what authoritarians do. They use the criminal justice system to go after and punish their opponents and try to throw their opponents in jail. And we don't do that here. But Bondi was more than willing to try. And that's one of the most outrageous things about her record.
Have we ever, is there anything in American history to compare to this? I mean, I think of, you know, every president sort of selects their own AGs to fulfill their vision. I remember Alberto Gonzalez and his U.S. attorney firing scandal under there, where they were trying to, you know, put their U.S. attorneys in place that would bring investigations regarding, you know, phony voter fraud, actually, right, back then. Of course, John Mitchell, Nixon's AG, was found guilty of conspiracy and obstruction and perjury. He went to jail for 19 months, I think.
Yep.
But has there any, I mean, did even Nixon or George W. Bush or anyone else actually order an attorney general to go out and prosecute a political enemy?
Well, I can't think of a particular example. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got to figure maybe some presidents tried.
Right.
You know, in the past, perhaps, but not where it's been so, certainly nothing like this, where it's been so open and obvious with Trump himself, you know, publicly posting that these people should be indicted, and then the Justice Department going on trying to do it, right? Certainly we've never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
And like with the U.S. attorney scandal you mentioned during the Bush administration, that was bad. They were trying to push out U.S. attorneys that they didn't think were being aggressive enough about pursuing basically bogus voter fraud cases against Democrats, but at least it was a scandal when it came to light, right?
Right? Okay.
There was an independent counsel. It was investigated. You know, people lost their jobs, you know, so it wasn't just accepted. Everybody recognized what a violation of norms that was. And like you said, John Mitchell, he was bad, but he went to jail. He got prosecuted.
Yeah.
You know, and now the standards have shifted so far that these things go on and you know, half the country just shrugs.
The standards have shifted so far that we're kind of begging the Florida Bar Association to please review her record and see. I mentioned, you know, at the top, this effort to sanction her via the Florida Bar. Do you see her record at DOJ itself as warranting sanction of some type along those lines? If so, for what exactly, really?
Yeah, it would, Yeah, I haven't looked at the actual text of the ethics complaint, so I'm not sure what they're focusing on, but you can certainly imagine, you know, allegations based on trying to bring these political lawsuits, for example, which would be certainly be an ethical violation, you know, going after someone for political reasons, even though the facts and law didn't support it, or, you know, lying to or misleading courts, you know, think that sort of thing, if they have allegations like that. So, yeah, it's certainly not out of the question to me that there would be a basis for ethics complaints for the Florida bar to look at.
I mentioned John Mitchell going to jail for conspiracy and obstruction under Nixon. And you mentioned, you know, ethical concerns you've had about Bondi. Do we know Bondi to be criminally complicit in any of these, I guess, crimes that we've sort of referred to today, especially since the Supreme Court has granted immunity to presidential crimes? Are there really any crimes here at all, in truth, that she might someday be held accountable for, as you see it, as you look at this long legacy of hers in just over 1 year in office?
I don't know. Crimes, you know, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously a lot of things we don't know about, you know, the things that may not be public yet. Most of what I see, most of the things I discuss in the blog don't clearly into the criminal category. They're mostly just abuse of power and abuse of your office, but things that aren't readily identifiable as necessarily criminal. But you'd have to do a lot more looking at specific allegations to, I think, to make that decision.
Your sidebars blog.com piece this week looks forward also to what's next for DOJ following Bondi's departure. For now, Trump's criminal defense attorney, I don't even think it's fair to call him his former criminal defense attorney, Todd Blanche, he'll now be serving as the acting AG. Frankly, it kind of feels to me like Blanche has really been running the place all along, even under Bondi. I don't know if you share that sense or not, but is there any reason to think that things will be any better under Blanche than under Bondi?
Not really. I mean, you know, one can always hope, right? But Blanche has been, again, her second in command, and he's been out there doing some pretty controversial things himself, as I noted in the piece, you know, including the interview of Ghislaine Maxwell, part of the Epstein files, which was really unorthodox, kind of went down and talked to her by himself for a couple of days. And then shortly after that, after she says that she never saw Trump do anything wrong, what a shock, then she gets transferred to a very cushy minimum security prison.
Yeah.
Even though she's not eligible to be there. And the administration has never really explained the reason for that move. And Blanche said some pretty incendiary things about being at war with judges and being proud that he cleaned house by firing everybody who was involved in any of the Trump prosecutions. So, you know, he's a true believer.
Yeah.
Whether he has a little bit more of an ethical compass than Bondi when it comes to pursuing some of these political cases and things like that, I don't know. We'll have to see. But it doesn't give you a lot of reason for optimism that he'll be any better.
No.
I mean, you've got to figure
anybody that Trump is
willing to appoint is going to have to pass his test of what he wants in an attorney general, which is someone who's willing to try to go after his enemies.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Be completely corrupt. Will you do that?
Apparently the reason the reporting is that he had fired Bondi for two main reasons, the handling of the Epstein files and the fact that he was unhappy that she wasn't more aggressive in prosecuting his enemies. And the thing is, you know, she tried. And not to give her credit is not the right term, but I mean, you know, Trump has to realize at least she tried. The problem is there are these pesky things built into the criminal justice system, like juries and grand juries and judges, you know, and you can't just take somebody out and throw them in jail. You have to go through that process. And that process largely thwarted these corrupt cases she tried to bring, which is a positive thing.
The requirement for evidence, stuff like that. Right. I'm not an attorney, but I'm pretty sure that's still required.
All these old-fashioned ideas you have.
Very quickly, been talk about Lee Zeldin, former congressman, currently heads the EPA. He's rumored to be, an actual replacement for Bondi. Jeanine Pirro, who's the U.S. attorney at
former
Fox News host. She's now running
running your old office, as I understand it, Randall. But really, why doesn't he just stick with Blanche? Is there any reason why he can't just stick with Blanche? Because that's who he seems to want, you know, his criminal defense attorney in charge. Seems like he prefers him. Is there any reason that he couldn't just remain in that role? Or does there have to be somebody else?
No, it doesn't have to be someone else. You could definitely appoint Blanche. And some of the reporting reading around here is that that's really what's going on, that this is sort of a trial run for the possible permanent appointment. So, you know, the Zeldin thing was reported, but that's certainly not in the bag.
Yeah.
And it would be sort of in line with Trump's past practices for him to appoint one of his criminal defense attorneys.
Sure. Yeah. Why wouldn't he? I mean, I think he had Blanche in there long before Bondi even went through all the confirmation processes and so forth. It seems like Blanche has kind of been running the place for a while. Why not just keep him there? Give up the ghost of this notion of somebody else, you know, pretending to be his AG. So I will, of course, point folks towards your piece at sidebarsblog.com, where I recommend folks sign up for your newsletter. This piece, Pam Bondi's Legacy of Destruction, which ends for today, we can celebrate that a truly bad person no longer holds one of the most powerful positions in the federal government. Tomorrow, however, the resistance goes on. Randall Eliason, the former chief of the Fraud and Public Corruption Section at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. He now teaches white-collar crime, criminal law, or the history thereof at George Washington University Law School. Randall, always great speaking with you, my friend. I look forward to the next time. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks. My pleasure.
You bet. Okay.
Wow.
So, yeah.
It's so stunning to hear someone with the institutional memory of Randall Eliason to talk about these things and about the difficulty of rebuilding the Department of Justice. And I can only say that I hope we get that chance.
Well, yeah, I hope we to even try to rebuild it at this point. Yeah, I hear you. I think we will. I'm confident we will, actually, that we will get the opportunity to try.
Well, we'll
whether
to,
we can succeed at that, that's a different matter. I mean, because as Randall said, there are people who have been, you know, working there for years and years, decades in many cases, who are now gone, who were fired, who quit, whether they will be willing to come back and restore that institutional knowledge to the place, that remains to be seen. We are in a whole new world at this point. So anyway, with Bondi gone, I don't take much comfort from that. I think some people did. I don't take much comfort from it. I think Todd Blanche has been running the whole thing from day one and will continue to do so, even if they get some figurehead to pretend to be the AG. As long as Todd Blanche is still there, he's still running it as Donald Trump's criminal defense law firm.
The corruption will continue as long as he's there.
Yep. All right, let's take a quick break, and we are back. Oh, your Green News Report.
Yes.
That'll cheer everything up, I'm sure. That's straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. You're listening to the broadcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. Weird day, huh?
Very.
Well, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report. More on Donald Trump's threats, which may or may not have played out by the time you listen to today's show and today's Green News Report. But let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
They're going to have no bridges. They're going to have no power plants.
Trump threatens war crimes against civilian power infrastructure in Iran. Iran war is boosting global demand for solar panels, heat pumps, and electric cars. Plus,
this is our worst snow year on record in Colorado.
Western snowpack has melted early, raising fears of a record fire season.
All of those fears and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I wonder if you think the rise in gas prices, Jameson, is more emotional than physical.
Wow, Fox News really working hard there. I'm pretty sure the $6 a gallon I paid to fill up my car over the weekend was physical. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, once again, energy and climate at the center of the day's news.
Yes, unfortunately. Global oil prices rose again after Donald Trump issued a profane threat to Iran on Easter Sunday that if Iran doesn't open the Strait of Hormuz by Tuesday night, the U.S. will bomb Iran's civilian power plants and bridges, which legal experts say would qualify as war crimes. Here's Tess Bridgman, former legal advisor to President Obama's National Security Council, on CBS News.
Electrical generating plants power hospitals. They power schools, water sanitation facilities, the things that you need to sustain basic day-to-day living for a civilian population. Obliterating all power plants, threatening coercive actions against the civilian population to try to bring a government to the negotiating table. Those kinds of things are flatly illegal.
Trump has presented no plan to open the Strait of Hormuz, has issued contradictory statements, and demanded other countries solve the conflict that he started. Iranian military leaders on Monday in a social media post said that, quote, the Strait will never return to its former state, especially for America and Israel.
Great job, Trump.
Iran's parliament approved a plan to collect tolls on vessels traveling through the strait, which analysts say will likely boost the price of oil and other goods for years to come.
Nailed it.
On Sunday, OPEC announced that it would boost oil production, but that had little effect on market prices. The International Energy Agency warned the global oil supply crunch will worsen over the month of April, and that shortages of jet fuel and diesel in Asia will expand to Europe. The Financial Times reports a global wave of energy rationing is escalating, with countries from Bangladesh to Zambia imposing new measures to curb fossil fuel use. South Korea, the Philippines, and other Asian countries say that they will burn more coal to make up for the shortfall. However, The Economist concludes that cheap, clean renewables will win out in the end.
Good.
As countries accelerate deployment of wind and solar sources that are not affected by geopolitics.
Will we finally learn that lesson this time?
CNBC reports that electric vehicle demand in Asia and Europe is getting a big boost from the energy crisis.
Excellent.
Quote, just as auto giants pivot back to combustion engines. Many countries are also seeing a huge jolt in sales of solar panels and electric heat pumps as the Iran war's impact on energy prices spurs more consumers around the world to abandon fossil fuels in favor of cheaper electric alternatives.
Well, what took you so long?
A BBC analysis finds that China stands to benefit the most from the war-driven energy crisis because it dominates renewable energy supply chains and produces the vast majority of the world's solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, and electric vehicles.
Well, I'm glad that Donald Trump killed all those industries here.
Finally, not great news for the U.S. West. Drought is deepening in several western states after a record warm winter and that historic, record-shattering heat wave in March that melted virtually all of the remaining thin mountain snowpack. Colorado and Utah both saw record low snow cover. California's reservoirs are now at below average levels, raising concerns among cities and the agriculture industry in the West of looming water shortages in the dry summer months. Forest managers are warning that dried out vegetation, heat, and drought are the ingredients for a potentially historic wildfire season, and not in a good way. And worse, there is a looming water crisis on the Colorado River with Lake Powell at very low levels.
You are right. That is not great news, to say the least.
Yeah.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
You don't miss your water till you ever run dry.
Mm-hmm. Though I think we didn't mention it there. I know you've mentioned it before. The well could run dry in Iran, depending on what happens over the next few hours and days.
Yes.
With those desalination plants that would be knocked out if he knocked out the power plants.
Yeah, which, of course, if you knock out a region's water system or even part of a region's water system, you're going to force people to leave, and that's going to lead to mass migration, and we know how well that always goes.
And genocide along with
it. Oh, yes. And then there's the genocide.
There's that.
Too.
Sure.
And, you know, I think one of the things that to throw back to the Alex Jones clip from earlier in the show when his guest said, have they considered the blowback, that there will be blowback? And that, I think, is the part that it doesn't seem like the Trump administration really thinks about. They don't seem to think about what Iran might do to retaliate. And that seems to be a severe strategic issue that they have.
Yeah, well, and they have said that they will respond in kind, essentially, if, in fact, Trump
follows through on
does
these threats.
This attack that he's promising. What that means with them following through in kind, well, I guess that remains to be seen. We are playing a very dangerous game for a very stupid reason. Actually, the reason, I don't even know what the reason is.
Nobody does.
Nobody knows. But, okay, here we go. This just in, coming from Reuters. Trump says he has agreed to suspend bombing, quote, bombing and attack of Iran for 2 weeks.
Okay.
Told you it was Taco Tuesday. AP now. President Trump pulls back on his Iran threats for 2 weeks, subject to Iran agreeing to ceasefire and to open Strait of Hormuz. And even NBC now. Trump agrees to a 2-week ceasefire if Iran commits to the, quote, complete, immediate, and safe opening of the Strait of Hormuz. So that'll settle it. That'll calm things down for the next, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes until he changes his mind again. Jesus Christ. All right. That's it. We're getting out. My thanks to our guest today, Randall Eliason of the DOJ, and formerly of the DOJ, now of George Washington Law School, to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. We are supported only by listeners like you who hit a donate button when you stop by bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you'll find me at the Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.